From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Political chaos in Haiti has led to yet another delay in their national elections. Since the violent overthrow of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 2 years ago, the Haitian elections have been postponed 4 times. More than 7 candidates are vying for the presidency. Many of them are part of previous regimes notorious for their corruption and brutality. The corruption within Haiti extends to local police forces and political leaders. And some question whether the gang-controlled regions of the nation will even participate in the proposed elections. Part of the political unrest includes kidnappings of foreign visitors and locals. In 2005, 25 Westerners were kidnapped in Haiti, including at least one North Carolinian. Later in the program, we'll talk with Frank Eaton, who returned to his home in Winston-Salem last night after a 3-day kidnapping ordeal. But first, we welcome Lauren Madelon. Lauren, of course, reports for us right here at North Carolina Public Radio and has just returned from covering the election preparations in Haiti. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you.
So give us a picture of the situation in Haiti. How chaotic is it?
Well, I don't think there are any superlatives that could describe it, despite the fact that there are many well-intended efforts on a part of very well-intended people to try and orchestrate a path towards elections. The fact is that the legacy of the overthrow or the kidnapping, depending on whom you talk to, of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004 has left a legacy of violence. The problem and the model that has seemed to be repeated throughout Haitian history is that each presidential leader suspicious of potential coup d'etats on the part of the army has established its own parallel force, thugs. In the case of the Duvalier regime, which started in 1957 and ended with his son in 1986, they were called the Tonton Macoutes. In the case of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, it was a group called the Chimères. And the Chimères are people who basically attacked the enemies of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He was accused of having lacked the power to rein them in, and as a consequence, the promise of a new era that he promised to usher in was compromised by the fact that his rule was corrupted by this violence that continues today, because there's a tremendous amount of resentment on the part of his followers, many of whom live in the poor areas of Port-au-Prince, the capital. They feel that he was unjustly removed, and as a consequence, many of his backers are trying to create a climate of violence in order to stymie the path toward an election this time.
So you can't even hold elections, and that does seem to be part of the problem. It seems these days you're either in power in Haiti or you're in jail.
Well, political scientists have called it a zero-sum game. You are either in and you have all the spoils of victory, or you're a loser and you're shut out completely. And that has had, throughout Haitian history, I might add, a history that is glorious from its outset, but that has devolved into a series of internecine fighting within Haitian society. And that has had the net effect of fostering violence, because if you're out, you need violence, or you're perceived to need violence to get back in. And if, on the other hand, you're in power, you're perceived, as I say, to need these political forces to buttress your regime. And as a consequence, you have different factions of society constantly at war, literally.
And while you were there, you managed to talk to, and not exactly a pristine interview situation, with one of the dissidents, a fairly well-known dissident who is at this moment in prison.
Well, just to set this up very briefly, one of the icons to Haiti's poor, and a man who is an unapologetic ally of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, is a priest. His name is Father Gérard Jean-Just. Now, he had been living in Miami. He was a Haitian activist in Miami. In July of this year, he went back for the funeral of a murdered journalist. He went to his church in Port-au-Prince. He was surrounded by thugs, people dressed in plain clothes. He was spat upon. He was beaten. He was taken away, allegedly under his own protection, for his own protection. He was taken to a police station. He was told he'd be released within 10 hours. He is now sitting, having not been released, in the National Penitentiary in Port-au-Prince, in that section of the National Penitentiary, I might point out, reserved for political prisoners, of which he is one of many. He was to declare himself a presidential candidate. He'd made no secret of that. The current interim government in Haiti is, once again, an unapologetic enemy of Aristide. They do not ever lack opportunities to show their disdain for him. And he is in prison. And the current prime minister, Gerald Latour, has said that, in fact, he should be there. Nothing's been done to help him. He is in jail, technically, because he is charged with connection with the murder of this journalist for whom he came back to attend the funeral. I went to the National Penitentiary I was trying to take some photographs of the outside of that penitentiary. And as I arrived there, I looked up, and who should it be but Gerard Jean-Just holding a photograph, a hand-painted photograph of Jesus, the metaphor being quite obvious. And I looked up to him and I said, you know, do you have a message for the outside world? And he said, all I can tell you is that freedom is dying and that I'm thirsting for freedom.
Freedom dies. Thirsting of freedom, that's all.
What's it like in there?
Without freedom is hell.
Without freedom is hell.
Okay, let's go.
Let's go, quickly. And then after that, I was with a Haitian colleague, and we got out of there as soon as we could, because at the same time that we were looking up from the, you know, we were within the grounds of the penitentiary where we should not have been, but, you know, the job of a reporter is to try and get to what you can do. We saw the soldiers coming up to us.
Well, we've been saying that corruption and chaos in the country are the cause of the delay, but that should be the cause of the election. What is it in particular that makes these elections so hard to hold on schedule?
The cynics would say that the interim government, which is precluded from having a membership in the next government, doesn't want to have an election. It wants to retain its position of power because, as we talked about that zero-sum game, once they're out, they're out. And so many people have felt that they have deliberately stymied an election. The technical reason for it, if you will, the logistical excuse that is given is that there has been an inability to issue voting cards. And the voting cards are just like what we need here. You go to the polls, you can't show up without identification. Now, the whole concept of national ID cards, national identification, is a very touchy issue there. And the Central Electoral Commission, which has been, I think, depending on whom you talk to, either inept or an ill-conceived body that just hasn't been able to get the job done, has simply not succeeded in importing the paper, the physical paper, from Mexico and actually getting it printed. And you have people all around begging, pleading, demanding these cards.
Since the overthrow of Aristide, there have been something like 9,000, I think, international peacekeepers in Haiti. Why are they not able to bring some stability to that country? And what is the role of the local police?
The local police are working in concert on a nominally, but the situation is so chaotic between the basically, if you oversimplify Haitian society politically, you have those who are backers of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and you have those who despise him, who feel that he betrayed his promise of a new era and was guilty of the same crimes as people like François and François and his son.
Duvalier's
yeah. son, right. And so as a consequence, you have groups basically loyal to the nominally right and the nominally left, that would be Aristide, facing off in the streets at all time. Now, the slums are defended by pro-Aristide people, according to these gang members, many of whom are involved not only in just political operations, a providing force for political reasons, but they're also criminally motivated. They're involved in kidnapping simply to finance themselves. But the situation is so terrible because the UN force, which has come in with the backing of the international community, especially with France and the United States, has been unable to penetrate certain parts of the slums in Port-au-Prince controlled by the gangs. Most of those gangs, at this point in time, as we speak right now, are gangs loyal to Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Now, at the same time, the Haitian National Police has a problem, and its new chief, Mario Andrasol, is a man highly regarded in the international community by Interpol, by the Drug Enforcement Administration. He's a former head of the Haitian Drug Squad, which is not an easy task at all. Haiti is impossible to police. It's got miles of coastline. We know right now that it's used as a transshipment point by Colombian drug cartels, who find it very easy to operate there, and they have penetrated the police force. And this new chief has involved himself in a purge. At great personal risk, he has gone and started a purge. And his name is Mario Andrasol. I went to speak to him at the headquarters of the Haitian National Police, and I began by asking him, you know, what are you doing to try and effect a purge?
I arrest many people, sometimes good, big people, you know, police officers involved in kidnappings and drug traffics. They cannot act like in the past. People will take this society in hostage to do their dirty business.
Now, in order to stop these people doing their dirty business, he's arrested people involved in recent massacres. He's arrested people involved with the Colombians. And he's also tried to say that he doesn't really care what happens to him. And when you speak to him, one really believes that. He is a Haitian patriot, extremely proud of his country's glorious history, once glorious history. And he says that he has a job to his country, and that job is to affect security before an election starts. But at the same time, he's not sure when the election happens, if anything is actually going to change.
The system is corrupted. The system is spoiled. You cannot have a new government in the same system. All the leaders should sit around the table and define the priority for Haiti. But unfortunately, everyone talks about only elections to be president. And at the same time, the system that we have now, the establishment, you know, is spoiled, it's corrupted.
And so what he is trying to do is affect security, but he's, again, he's somewhat, I wouldn't say cynical, but he's questioning. He's not sure that anything's going to change because he sees people jostling for power, and at the same time, he doesn't see anybody. You know, he told me he's very moved by people dying in the streets, and he's not able to do anything about it until he can affect security in preparation for an election.
Hopes and fears in Haiti as elections approach, delayed one more time. On the state of things, that's what we're talking about today, as well as the exile community here in North Carolina, taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Just ahead, we'll get to those calls, and documentary filmmaker Frank Eaton, who just returned to the U.S. yesterday after being kidnapped and ransom paid for him. He's returned to his home in Winston-Salem. We'll talk with him, take your phone calls, and take a look at the Haitian community in North Carolina. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina Public Radio's WUNC's Lauren Matlin is with me in the studio today. He's recently returned from Haiti. We're taking your calls today about Haiti, Haitian elections, as well as Haitians here in North Carolina. 877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation. Right now, I'm joined by Frank Eaton. He's a Winston-Salem documentary filmmaker who was kidnapped in Haiti last week, held for ransom for 3 days, released last night, and is on the phone with me now. Frank Eaton, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about your experience. You were with a Haitian radio personality.
Yes. Too bad that he's not on the radio with us now. He's much better at this than I am.
Well, tell us what happened. What were you doing? And tell us about the kidnapping.
Well, let's see. I've been in town in Port-au-Prince for about 3 weeks, working on a documentary. And I had read an article about this guy, Aaron Maximilian, who is known as the Haitian hillbilly. And he plays sort of a punk rock, you know. He has this radio show, the only person playing rock and roll in Haiti. And I had demanded to meet him, and I met him, and we really hit it off, and he was the focus of my documentary, essentially. And then 3 weeks later, we get picked up and taken to Cité Soleil by armed guys who hijacked us outside of my house and drove us.
Where was that? What part of...
I am in Pétionville. Essentially, as you go up the hill from the... Port-au-Prince is a bowl, you know. There's the downtown is at the bottom of the bowl by the water. As you go up the hill, the neighborhoods become, quote-unquote, safer and wealthier. And I was living halfway up the hill in Pétionville, which was considered pretty safe when I was there. There were a lot of UN patrols. And around Christmas time, the patrols kind of slacked off and kidnappings picked up in Pétionville, unbeknownst to me. I mean, I was kind of like, well, where are the UN guys, you know? When I first got here, you couldn't walk a block without being passed by somebody. And things quieted down and also heated up at the same time. And we were taken on the same night as, like, 9 or 10 other people.
So tell us about the conditions that you were held in.
The conditions that I were held in were probably the best conditions in all of Cité Soleil. We were treated very well. You know, the Haitians are essentially a very, very, very hospitable people. They don't have a whole lot, and we were fed, given bottled water and cigarettes and the occasional
and
beer.
Did they tell you why you were kidnapped?
I'm sorry?
Did they tell you why they took you and what they were demanding?
It's a financial thing. Yeah. It's a total financial thing. It's not, you know, I knew, it was terrifying, but essentially I knew this is a financial thing. I'm not a political enemy, you know. I'm not a rival gang leader, you know. So I'm going to be okay if we can get some money to these people.
What were they asking for?
Well, at first, you know, they were asking for $10 million for both of us. And that went down to $2 million for both of us. And then I was released for $10,000, which is essentially the going rate for, you know, a guy like me.
And you are still making this film? Are you going to go back?
Yeah, I love Haiti, and I think that it's probably, if I can go back responsibly, if I can go back and not repeat the mistake that I made this time, which was probably putting some people in risk, actually, probably putting other people in risk. I was brought out by people who put their lives at risk. You know, you don't walk $10,000 U.S. cash into, you know, one of the most dangerous slums in the Western Hemisphere and not be a pretty brave guy.
So tell us a little bit about what those precautions, not the precautions so much, but can you make a documentary in a place like Haiti when if you have to take that many precautions? I mean, can you get the story if you can't get where you need to go?
You can. I mean, unfortunately, or, you know, whatever. I mean, nothing is unfortunate about the situation because I'm alive. But, you know, there's obviously no footage of this event. But I have a lot of stuff, and the people that I was working with are fantastic. There are a lot of journalists there. There are people doing some very brave reporting. I was not one of them, you know. I did some very brave sitting in a room for 3 days while other people were doing some brave actual, you know, moving about and putting their lives at risk. I was at much less risk than the people who pulled me out of there, and that's that makes me feel a little bad, and I don't want to do that to folks again. So, if it's possible, I would like to return.
Well, Lauren Matalon is with us. He has just returned and is one of those journalists, and I know he has a question for you.
Sure.
Yeah, Frank, I'm just curious. You said you were taken from Pétionville and taken on down. I'm just wondering what the circumstances were when you were actually taken, because it's quite a distance, obviously, from Pétionville down to Cité Soleil. I was in both places. I spent a lot of time in Cité Soleil, La Saline, and I'm just wondering how it was that you were able to make it down undetected on the part of your kidnappers.
Yeah, we did not pass a UN checkpoint. Supposedly, somehow, Cité Soleil is supposed to be, there's supposed to be a checkpoint there. There's supposedly, you know, this is a closed neighborhood. We went down Pan American and got into an accident, actually, sideswiped somebody, and then took off north. I mean, through Del Mar somewhere, and, you know, I think we came in through the airport. I was kind of hunched down, and my geography of the lower part of the, you know, the outskirts of Cité Soleil and the airport are not very good.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Frank, very much for speaking with us today.
Sure, thank you.
Frank Eaton is a Winston-Salem filmmaker. He returned home last night after being kidnapped and held for ransom for 3 days in Haiti. Joining us now are Jean-Luc Charles. Jean-Luc is an assistant minister at White Rock Baptist Church in Durham. He immigrated to the United States with his family in 1979 from Haiti. Jean-Luc, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
And I guess kidnapping is not the sole province of foreigners. You were saying earlier that your uncle had been kidnapped.
That's right. My uncle and my aunt run a school in Port-au-Prince, and he was just kidnapped right before the Christmas holiday and made several demands on him, on his life, and they were able to pay the ransom. They were able to pay the ransom, and he's actually here in the States with us.
And is he planning to go back?
They are planning to go back. They run a school. They have about 1,000 students, and they feel like this is the work that God has placed on their hearts and that their students depend on them. But you also know that the economy in Haiti, really, it's all interdependent. So if they're not there to help create that economy, then a lot of people are not able to work. So.
Well, tell us about these elections and how closely the exile community is watching the elections in Haiti.
Well, you know, there isn't a big exile community here in North Carolina, but certainly in Miami, in New York, in Boston, everywhere you look in the newspapers, on the web, Haitians are talking about it. I think, though, it's very difficult for the young Haitian community because we're so accustomed to so much bad news. After Aristide, I think our hearts were broken, and our sense of what hope lies in the future for Haiti is really dim. And given the fact that the elections have been postponed for 4 times, we're really disappointed about it.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation. Carl is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Carl.
Yes, I agree with the last caller because Haiti, there is no hope for Haiti now. Haiti is a jungle. Because the problem is since 1804, everybody that ever been to power, they only get that just for their own political gain and economical gain. That's why the country is so poor, so devastated. And the problem with the security, they are all responsible for that. We cannot, it's a bunch of thieves in power in Haiti.
All right, Carl, well, thank you for that.
And I agree with Carl in the sense that there is a sense of despair, but part of it is because it seems like it really doesn't take that much to take care of Haiti, to fix Haiti. Mm. From everything that you hear, at least from the diaspora community, the UN is not doing anything there. And we wonder why they're there and why they're not doing anything. And I think Haitian Americans who have grown up here in democracy, who are accustomed to the sort of the tussle and bustle of democracy, are wondering, well, you know, what can we do at the same time when the insecurity is so large? So it's not a matter of not wanting to go. It's not being able to even be secure to do anything.
Yeah, but there was something else at the heart of Carl's question, too, that leads to the bigger question, why is it that the United Nations or the United States or anybody should be playing such a big role? The history of Haiti is such that, and I think Carl goes back to 1804 and said it's always been that way, but has it? There was a time when Haiti was the shining jewel of the Caribbean and the New World.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. I mean, its leader, revolutionary leader Toussaint Louverture, framed a constitution that was quoted by the leaders of Europe, starting at the end of the 1700s. But here's the problem. The problem is that here's a country that, armed with machetes and a smart guerrilla warfare tactic, you know, defeated the finest armies of Europe, basically defeated Napoleon, who stopped off in Haiti on his way to put down what he thought was a little slave rebellion on his way to the Americas. He got defeated, his brother-in-law died there, and he was so bankrupted by the experience that he ended up selling Louisiana and the Louisiana Purchase to the United States. Haiti's had a great effect on modern history that people don't realize. And the fact is that at that point, the United States started putting a blockade on Haiti. It started being very upset that in its backyard, here was a country that had defeated the finest armies of Europe, abolished slavery, and was trying to declare principles of liberty that were on paper in the United States, but certainly not in practice. And then from then on, I mean, just again, collapsing a very long and amazing history, the American Marines, under the pretext of trying to provide security after the assassination of President Sam in 1915, stayed there for 19 years. They conscripted people to build roads. They shot people who didn't cooperate with them. There was a famous guerrilla leader, Peralt, who was actually killed after he was betrayed to the United States Marines. And in order to prove that he was dead, they literally tied him to a doorpost in Cap Haitien. And that, to this day, is a photograph that is a rallying point for Haitian nationalists to this day. Now, you've also had France. France put every blockade in possible. They said, you know what? There's a country that has become independent. We want reparations. We want to be paid back, you know, for the fact that our colony has now been taken away from us by the Haitian people. And then you had a history of internal leadership that was corrupt and just in there for self-enrichment.
So there's Lauren Maddell on the history of Haiti. Do Haitians feel that sense of pride, that sense that is their history? Or was it Carl's take on Haitian history that it's been this kind of power struggle from the beginning?
Well, I think Haitians are certainly aware that politics in Haitian culture is the life of the culture. Everybody talks about politics, and it's very aggressive. It's an aggressive conversation. But at the same time, there's undeniable for us the fact of racism and what role racism has played in the history of Haiti. The fact that you have this black republic at the time that American slavery was still going on, which was an inspiration for African Americans, particularly in this area of North Carolina, Haiti being named after Haiti. So you have all of those dynamics happening at the same time, and I think Haitians are caught up in those dynamics even now. For instance, you have supporters of Aristide who are mostly from the Democratic side versus those who wanted to overthrow Aristide who are mostly Republican. So you still have that same dynamic playing itself out. Also, Haitians are asking the question, we're not that far from Cuba. Why can't Haitians come over here like Cubans can income? And why can't there be a declaration, a recognition of the humanitarian crisis that's absolutely happening in Haiti right now? It's a question of racism. That's undeniable.
Is there a sense in the among the diaspora community that there that they can do, that you can do something about it? And what is that? What is it that you'd want to do?
Well, I think the diasporan community is still divided between, you know, so-called pro-Aristide, still divided between an ambiguity about what the role of the U.S. should be in Haitian politics. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's a recognition of the responsibility that we have. I don't think there's a shirking away from saying, wait a minute, we're Haitians, we grew up here in this country, and we have a responsibility to name Haiti and to make sure that people know how important this country is.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. If you want to join our conversation about Haiti, its upcoming elections postponed yet again because of the turmoil in that country. My guest, Jean-Luc Charles, is assistant minister at White Rock Baptist Church in Durham. Lauren Madelon, WUNC North Carolina Public Radio reporter. And your phone calls, 877-962-9862. Jean Richard is on the line from Durham. Hello, Jean Richard.
Hi. Good afternoon. I'm glad that you're having this program on the air. I'm currently from Florida, but I live in Durham right now. But I'm glad that your guest has just mentioned about Haiti. One thing I want to kind of clarify is that Haiti is more complex. Just like your journalist has just said, it's a very, very complex situation. Sometimes people try to link the kidnapping to Aristide partisan, but it's more complex than that because we have a situation in Haiti where you have politicians who want to remain in power for life because there are no other opportunities. And then you have a lot of thugs, a lot of bad people that the U.S. send in Haiti, along with other thugs that you have in the country, that create a more complex situation where kidnapping are done in a very sophisticated way. And it's more than just Aristide or people who are against Aristide. It's a very more complex situation. We need to look at the impact that the U.S. have on sending people for whatever situation, all the gangs, members, say people who do bad things, and they send them back to Haiti, and that even exacerbates the situation that we currently have in a very fragile country.
Jean Richard, thank you for that call.
Yeah, I agree with Jean Richard that the history of Haiti is inextricably linked to violence, and the sense of violence that's connected with the politics is so lively and so there. And I think the rash of kidnappings has sort of showed up that there's so much violence in Haitian culture also, and that's undeniable. And Haitians have to somehow deal with the fact that there's so much violence in our culture.
And every time you read about the situation in Haiti, you see some complaints that the U.S. isn't doing enough. And then along the lines of Jean Richard's question, well, the U.S. may be part of the problem, that the fact is that the way the U.S. has intervened in the past has, at least in my perception, and I want to hear from you, Jean-Luc, whether or not that is perceived as part of the problem in Haiti.
Well, the U.S. has not had a history of positive intervention in Haitian culture and Haitian politics. Unfortunately, the policies and the way that the U.S. views Haiti and its role in the Western Hemisphere has not been positive. So at times, Haitians are ambiguous. Should the U.S. come in? Should the U.S. do more? But at the same time, what is the U.S. doing? And how are the U.S. interests aligned with Haitian interests? Part of my disappointment with Jean-Bertrand Aristide was I had a sense that he was going to sort of stand up to the U.S. and say, hey, this is what's important to us as Haitians. And that seemed to happen during his first presidential cycle. And then, of course, you know, he was ousted. And where was the U.S. then to really support that fragile democracy? And then when he came back, he seemed to come back with some anger and some vengeance. And so you can almost see a very different Aristide in the second take than you did in the first take. And I think there's got to be something there.
Lauren?
I think that we can see very clearly two examples of a really polar opposite behavior by the United States. Aristide was duly elected. He was then overthrown. And it took 3 years for the United States to get rid of a very weak military government with absolutely no credibility before he was returned. He was returned. He was then precluded from running again. He was succeeded by René Préval, who's a big figure in this year's elections, whenever they're actually going to be held. When he was then reelected, there are people like Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia University who have said that the Bush administration, that is Bush the Younger, made it a priority to get rid of Aristide because the views of George Bush sort of coincided with the 1% elite that lives in opulence and controls Haiti, And they did not want Aristide, a symbol, an icon to the poor, a man who had been outspoken, you know, a liberation theologist, notwithstanding the fact that he had left the church to become a politician. So here you had two opposite sort of signals being sent by Washington.
That said, Jean-Luc, is there much doubt in the minds of most Haitians that Jean-Bertrand Aristide had become corrupt, that his administration had on its own become corrupt, or was it the influence of the United States, its resistance to U.S. efforts to globalize that?
I don't think there was much doubt, although, you know, when you look at the websites and you read different Haitian newspapers, even in Creole, it's very divided. I mean, it's some who think, no, Aristide is a saint, he's done nothing wrong, and then there are others who are very disappointed at what he's done, even people who are pro-Aristide in the past. At the same time, I think there is a sense in which the second Aristide was a very different person than the democratically elected Aristide. And I think if there's a point of contention, it's why did it take so long to return Aristide to power? And what was lost in that interim? There was so much hope. Haitians were actually going back to Haiti. There was almost a reversal of that whole immigration. There was so much hope. People were buying land. They thought that, okay, this time we can bring all of our intelligence, what we've learned from France, what we've learned from living in Canada, what we've learned from living in the U.S., and we can build our country. We can have a place to bring our children, our grandchildren.
We will talk more about Haiti, its future, and the future of the diasporan community and what that means in a place like North Carolina, talking about Haiti today with Jean-Luc Charles and documentary, and as well as Lauren Madelon, who is a documentary maker for National Public Radio and WUNC as well. Just ahead, more of your phone calls and more talk about Haiti on the State of Things. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking today about political instability in Haiti before the Haitian elections, which have been postponed again. They had been scheduled for January 8th. Now they're postponed and no new date has been set. Talk about how that instability affects Haitians here in North Carolina. Haiti remains dangerous for outside journalists and aid workers. It's a very poor country. In 2004, Tracy Gaudet experienced the perils of Haiti's political instability firsthand when she traveled to the country to adopt the infant son of a teenager who could not afford to care for him. Tracy Gaudet is director of the Duke Center for Integrative Medicine. She joins us now. Tracy, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
We're taking your phone calls as well, 877-962-9862. So, Tracy, tell us how you became involved in the Haitian community.
Well, initially, my husband had gone down to Haiti to do a medical mission week. And at the same time, we were investigating international adoptions. And we were both so moved by the community there, the culture, the people, their open-heartedness. You know, so much of the conversation is always about the negative side of the culture. And I just want to say, especially after spending 3 months there in interesting times, that I've never been in such a place of such love and open-heartedness as Haiti. So we decided if we were going to adopt, we would love to adopt from a place where we felt there was great need and a place where we could continue to have a relationship and involvement in the culture.
Warm and loving people, but the bureaucracy, not so tender.
Exactly.
It didn't go.
Very well said.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the process.
Well, I went down. Things started to get unsettled, and there was a travel advisory, and my husband and I decided we should go down and try to finalize the adoption before things got worse. And this was February 2004, and we went down. Rich was planning to be there for 5 days, and I was going to be there for 10 and hopefully get things wrapped up. He left, and then the government collapsed. So Ryan, my son, and I were there for 3 months, actually, not being able to get out again until May.
Were you aware of just how unstable it was, that this was a possibility that you'd be stuck?
Well, certainly not. I think I was naive. I think we were all naive, the degree of the instability and the ramifications that would have happened. And that really the U.S. Embassy was willing to get me out. They were evacuating everyone, and they said, oh, well, we'll get you out. You need to leave. We're all leaving. But they wouldn't let me bring Ryan, and I wasn't about to leave without my son.
Ultimately, you succeeded, though.
Yes. 3 months later, we came home.
And you still go back. Do you fear for your safety?
It's interesting. It's been challenging. The last trip that Ryan and I had scheduled to go back, well, the three of us had scheduled to go back after our friends in Haiti advised us not to go back because of the kidnapping situation. My husband went, but Ryan and I stayed at home. So it's been challenging in the summer I was so anxious to see our friends and our what feels like our family from Haiti that we actually decided to meet in the Dominican Republic, which everyone felt would be safe for Ryan and myself. So we brought them over from Haiti and we met there, but we're very anxious to get back to Haiti.
Jean-Luc, we've talked a little bit about the dangers for foreigners going back. Do you feel like you can go back? Is it safe for you?
Well, I don't feel like it's safe for me. I've gone back to Haiti twice now since I came in 79, most recently about a year ago with Family Health Ministries. I'm a board member of that organization and went back, went to Haiti, went to Fondois, loved it. It was wonderful. As I said, my aunt has a school there, so I was able to stay with family some in Port-au-Prince, but really felt that it's not at this point a place where you can just come and go. And our church had scheduled a trip. I'm the director of missions for White Rock Baptist Church. We scheduled a trip to go with Family Health Ministries. At the last minute, the week we were leaving, the State Department issued a travel advisory and said they would not be responsible for our going. And so we decided as a church family not to go.
What can aid workers do? What can outside aid workers and organizations do in Haiti, given the turmoil?
Well, I don't know what they can do in Haiti, but I think that we can put much more pressure on our own government to take a serious look at Haiti and to ask, what are some things that we're not doing structurally? What are some things that, how are we creating a situation of instability? I've met so many Americans who have a heart for Haiti, who love Haiti, and there's a big question, okay, on the individual basis, we're doing things, but what are we doing structurally? How are our policies? Nobody's asking the policy questions. How are our policies affecting Haiti for good or for bad? And are there some changes that we can make, not just one person going down, affecting not just a mission trip like myself going, but what are some policy questions?
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation about the future of Haiti and the Haitian community in North Carolina and around the country. Bonnie's on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Bonnie.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Thank you very much for all your wonderful comments. I chair something called the Haiti Connection, and we are a coalition group that works on both medical trips and educational trips, and know Jean-Luc well and appreciate his comments. We have maybe 12 to 14 organizations in the Triangle that work in Haiti, and four groups are going down in January. And I would like to know how Jean-Luc thinks that we can support people who are working on the political issues in Haiti.
That's a great question. Hi, Bonnie. It's good to talk to you again. I think that we need to ask questions, first of all, at the state level, our state representatives, our senators, and ask them, how are they voting on issues that pertain to Haiti? Perhaps take a fresher look at how our policies have an effect on Haiti. We need to have those conversations, and I don't see us as Carolinians having those types of conversations. Although, as I said, I've met so many wonderful people here, especially in North Carolina, who have Haiti in heart, but we have to take it to the next level.
You know, apart from the direct involvement, whether or not the U.S. continues to support you with the U.N. troops and that sort of thing, what are some of the policies in terms of economic policy that you'd like to see the U.S. focus on?
Well, I'll give one example. The Haitian Election Board asked the U.S. to provide 10 helicopters to assist with the distribution of identity cards, and the U.S. said no. Just 10 helicopters would have made such a huge difference in getting this process rolling forward. In the past, we've had the Carter Center come in and do some things. In the past, we had the TransAfrica with Randall Robinson, who's no longer president of TransAfrica, do some things. So there are some bigger picture issues as well.
Look, there's a cynical point of view that says that that the U.S. and other Western countries, the more developed countries, really don't want to see stability in Haiti or other small countries because it allows them to insert dictatorships or assert the kind of control that keeps, frankly, labor cheap. That's the cynical point of view. How would you respond to that?
Well, I don't believe that. I choose to be an optimist. We have a great country, and from having been here and feeling like this is my second home, this is my home, this is the home that I know, that I know the people here, their hearts are in the right place. And, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. And I think that as we look at Haiti, it's only 90 miles off the coast of Florida. It's 2 hours from here. You're closer to Haiti from Durham, North Carolina, than you are to California. So as we look at Haiti, we can look and say, okay, what are some things, some ways of connecting?
Lauren?
I want to say that the United States has something, American citizens have a lot at stake in this election, even though they might not realize it. And that is the fact that the longer instability is created in Haiti, the more there is an opportunity on one level for Colombian cocaine drug dealing rings and the violence that is attendant to their activity to penetrate a very difficult to patrol coastline, and the lawlessness and the sort of power vacuum that is in, that is prevailing there is taken advantage of by these people, to the point that right now in the port of Gonaive, which is north of Port-au-Prince on the western side of the country, through which they say that 8% of the known detected cocaine entered the United States last year, Gerard Latotou, the current leader of the country's nephew, is said to be connected to drug gangs, and he's never actually quite denied that. My point being that it's the lawlessness and the chaos and the turmoil prevalent there that that affords an opportunity for criminal activity to move in. That affects the well-being of this country, and if for no other reason, if not for humanitarian reasons, and it's a shame if it wouldn't be for those reasons, but if for no other reason, we need to pay attention to insecurity in Haiti for that reason.
Well, also, there's the issue of terror. I mean, Haiti and the lawlessness is so serious that it's certainly an opportunity for terror networks to set up and go undetected because there's simply no known law. There's no, you know, there's no law there.
And here you have, you know, a police chief, a maverick, who says, I have at least 25% of my forces corrupt. He's now using public service announcements on the radio on the part of that the United States Embassy is saying, you know, if you see any weapons or cash, it's called the U.S. Embassy. I went and I asked the chief, I said, do you feel compromised by the fact that the U.S. Embassy is doing that? He said, on the contrary, I'm grateful for the help because, frankly, if you weren't there, would you trust my force?
So you turn
of course not.
You turn in your weapons at the embassy, not to the police department.
Because it's riddled with informants who might kill you.
I want to turn our attention a little bit to the diasporan community here. In a state like North Carolina, Tracy Gaudette, you have a son who you've adopted from Haiti. Do you feel any need to connect him with the Haitian community here and keep contact? How do you do that?
Well, we're learning how to do that. I feel a tremendous need to do that. Actually, part of the reason I was enthused to be a part of the show was I would, just by being here, meet other Haitian Americans and develop that community further. But I think that there is such a special nature of the Haitian culture that both by trips back to Haiti, and of course there are limitations on that, as we've said, but also being linked in community with other Haitian Americans here will be very, very important as Ryan grows.
Jean-Luc, how do you do that? You said the Haitian population in North Carolina is pretty small. I imagine it's dispersed. How do you keep together?
Well, it's very interesting. My neighbor's Haitian. I didn't know that until I bought the house. So there are little graces that come about. I've actually met more Haitians through American networks, through Haiti Connection, through Family Health Ministries, through other organizations. I've actually met other Haitians because I think most of us are pretty well integrated into the society. There isn't a standout, you know, there isn't a place where you can go and say, okay, all the Haitians are hanging out here. I've met Haitians in the supermarket. One time I was shopping and I looked at somebody's basket and I saw some plantains and I saw some rice and beans and I said, are you Haitian? So I've met Haitians that way. I've met Haitians through Duke University. I was a student at the Divinity School, so I met some Haitians through there and through Central.
And do you make an effort to stay together culturally and whether there are customs or practices that you try to reproduce here, or is assimilation more important?
Yeah, I haven't been that good at at staying connected. For instance, for the 1st of January, it's a big Haitian celebration, and usually you have pumpkin soup, and you go around and you take your pumpkin soup, but I didn't make any pumpkin soup. So.
Next year, Jean-Luc, we'll do pumpkin soup.
The pumpkin soup. And how about in terms of the elections again? I know in a place like South Florida where there's a large concentration of Haitian exiles, it's important to the extent that Haitian politicians have gone to South Florida to campaign. So it's very important.
That's right. That's right. I think for those of us who are outside those big centers, we stay connected through family. So my family in Connecticut, you know, family in Brooklyn, family in Florida, family in Atlanta, those places have a lot of Haitians and a lot of Haitian Americans, and so we stay connected on the web through phone calls and so on and so forth to try to find out what's going on.
877-962-9862 if you want to join our conversation. Marlo's on the line from Cary. Hello, Marlo.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment that I'm getting ready to go to Haiti on Saturday for a mission trip, and we do a medical clinic out in the country, and I can see firsthand the devastation of the country, but as people have said earlier, the Haitian people are so wonderful, and it always hurts me so much to hear in the news the negative things when there's so many positive things about Haiti.
And Marlo, there are places, I guess, where you cannot go. Is that right?
Yes. When I get to Port-au-Prince, there will be people there to meet me and will keep me in places where it will be safer. Won't go any dangerous areas.
Well, thank you very much for your call. 877-962-9862. At least to the question, Jean-Luc, there are so many aid agencies and NGOs who are going in and coming out that they are really carrying some information, I suppose. Do you rely on their testimony and their reporting to get the latest information?
That's right. I think we, you know, you listen to the NGOs, you listen to people who are in Haiti, you listen to Haitians who have gone back and forth, and actually, sometimes you hear different things. I think for us, if in the Haitian community who live here, when you go back to Haiti, there's so much shock that sometimes you yourself are, you know, you're more scared to go to Haiti than Americans who are going all the time. I mean, you know, Dave Walmer just left for Haiti from Family Health Ministries, and I wouldn't go. But again, it's that shock of, okay, this is where I'm from, but then there's that connection. When I talk to my family, of course, family members who are on the ground, so you see different things. I think Port-au-Prince is not safe. The countryside is safe. From all accounts, the countryside is very safe.
You know, it's really interesting that in the countryside to this day, you have this notion of almost like a Quaker-like collectivism.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They're called the combite. You know, in other words, if a neighbor's house goes down, people will come around mm-hmm. and help you. They plow the fields together. They have shared labor. That concept is alive, and much the way we've seen a flight from the country to the cities all over the world, and with it a commensurate loss of cultural identity, we've seen the same thing in Haiti, and it's very sad. That being said, I'd like to echo the comments of our colleagues here today. I met people there who have nothing and were willing to give me everything they had. I met people who were willing to protect me for no reason. They had no reason to do that. I've never met such a warm, wonderful people.
But are people leaving, Jean-Luc, mostly for economic reasons?
Yeah, my family left for economic reasons. Of course, the political instability is connected with that, and I think you can't separate the economics from the political instability. And that's going to increase because Haitians depend on NGOs. They depend on other Haitians going back and forth. They depend on the diaspora going into Port-au-Prince. They depend on people sending money. They depend on people starting schools like my aunt has done. And so as the instability increases, of course, the economic situation is going to get dire.
What leads you to come to a place like North Carolina rather than, say, South Florida?
I came here for school. I attended the Divinity School, so I came down. I was very surprised to find other Haitians. I thought I would never speak Creole. I've spoken more Creole here in North Carolina than I did when I lived in Brooklyn, so yeah.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation. We're talking today about the Haitian elections. So, Jean-Luc, let me ask you how optimistic you are that these elections will be held at all. There are those who say, we're never going to see elections in Haiti.
Yeah, I have to be optimistic. Our church did a prayer service for the elections when they were scheduled in December. And we brought a group of people together just to pray and spend some time, you know, asking the Lord to bless these elections. I have to be optimistic because there are so many people who care about Haiti. I have to be optimistic because there are Haitian Americans now saying, okay, this is part of me. I'm not just an American. I'm somehow connected and trying to find my place in Haiti. So I don't know what will actually happen in the immediate future, but my hope is there. My hope is there.
I think Haiti needs to overcome the fact that there are sections within all sectors of society who don't want the situation. They profit
That's
by the status
right.
quo,
right.
and that has to change.
Lauren Madelon, reporter for North Carolina Public Radio, thank you. Jean-Luc Charles, an assistant minister with White Rock Baptist Church in Durham, I want to thank you. And Tracy Godet, director of the Duke Center for Integrative Medicine, thank you all for being on the program today.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. You can drop us a comment at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.